Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is Wednesday, the 5th of August, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we're very happy that you are with us this morning, as we always are. Let me introduce the panel to you. I also want to remind you that you can be a part of our program by simply emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Simple as that, and we would love to hear from you on a wide range of topics that we'll be discussing this morning. Now, to the folks who are going to be on the panel, here they are. WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, Alan. How is things?
I'm present.
Excellent. And accounted for and all of that.
Present and accounted for, Chief.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Good to know. We now move on to Times Union columnist Chris Churchill. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I too.
What's funny about that?
I'm too. I'm good. Yeah, you seem like I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. I keep telling myself I'm going to be good. Immigration attorney and associate with the Albany law firm of Whiteman Osterman and Hannah, Sienna Freeman Tolbert is with us. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Happy to be here.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. And Sydney Newpaltz, communications professor, former New York State Senator Terry Gibson. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, too.
Excellent.
I'm happy to be good.
Yeah. You know, I think with all that's going on, good is that's fine, right? We'll take that. That sounds like a good, happy medium.
That sounds good.
Let's go to the stories for this morning. We'll start off and talk about how this has been up and down. Are we close? Are we not close? Are we going to get there? Are we not going to get there? The White House and Democrats agree to try for a coronavirus relief deal on evictions and employment by the end of the week. The end of the week. It would be a week after the $600 expired. And it would probably not be voted on until early next week. But the White House and Democratic leaders agreed to try to finalize the deal to address lapsed unemployment benefits and eviction restrictions by the end of the week and hold a vote in Congress early next week, suddenly trying to rush stalled talks in the face of growing public and political unrest. Senior White House officials said Tuesday that they made very concrete offers to Democrats related to unemployment benefits and eviction protections. And after days of bickering, both sides now appear to be trying to secure a compromise. The agreement on a timeline came in a meeting with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. The four have been meeting almost daily for a week. Their agreement Tuesday on a specific timeline to reach an overall deal constituted the most concrete progress yet. Alan, how much faith do you have that a deal will be set?
No, I think that they have to do a deal. You can believe me that they all have pollsters. They're all polling, and they're finding massive dissatisfaction. The question is, who is being held more accountable? And I can't believe that it isn't the president. So the president says, I'm stepping out of this, and I'm going to let the others do the negotiating. I call BS. That is nonsense. Of course, the president is calling in the plays, and we have to believe that, as he always has. And he reserves the right, once they come up with a solution, to say, no, this doesn't suit me, which, of course, we know he has done in the past. His own daughter told everybody about that. So the people are disgusted with this president. The polling is showing it. There's a need out there, but as he says, it is what it is. He doesn't particularly care what it is, as long as he thinks it gives him some advantage. But I think they're playing for an advantage, but they can't find one, the Republicans, right now. And so I think what I've been saying from day one is, instead of not $1 billion, not $3 billion, but $2 billion is where they're going to come out. I'm so sorry. You are exactly right. That's where we are. It's taking a long time. They all have to play to the bases, but the Republicans have to play more to their base than the Democrats do.
But you do see the White House taking an active role in the sense of, you have Steve Mnuchin, you have Mark Meadows in the negotiations. Conspicuously absent, though, is is Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, but in the end, McConnell goes along. He is a presidential sycophant. We know that. And as I have just I started by saying, I really don't believe that the president is not involved in this. These are his chess pieces. He's pushing them. And it may well be because of his penchant for upsetting the apple cart that he'll do just that at the end.
Chris.
Well, I agree with Alan that both sides have a really strong incentive to get something done and get it done relatively quickly. I mean, you know, I think whichever side was seen as blocking progress in this will really take a lot of heat and take the brunt of the frustration from voters. I think importantly for readers in this area or listeners in this area is the fact that there doesn't seem to be any agreement on money for state and local governments, which, is potentially a really, really big deal. I mean, you're looking at governments that may have to cut jobs, cut teachers, cut cops, defund the police, in essence. And, the economic ramifications for places like upstate New York and western Massachusetts are huge.
So if you were a betting man, what would you bet? Do you think that in the end they'll have to do something because that is a major Democratic demand?
I would think they would have to do something. I mean, I think the pressure on Schumer, the Governor Cuomo, will, his head will pop off if they, and I would think that the pressure would be pretty great. I mean, it just makes sense from an economic standpoint, right? I mean, if Trump's trying to get reelected, he obviously wants to get the economy rolling. One way to really hinder that is to have governments all across the country laying people off. That would have a ripple effect throughout the entire economy, and it would really, really make it almost impossible for him to show the kind of economic progress he probably wants to show by Election Day.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to take the loss, right? He doesn't want to say, okay, I lost this one. He's the art of the deal man, right, Chris? And
Weird.
And he has a way of doing counterproductive things, which is what has gotten him into the doghouse already.
Yeah, and he may, somewhere he may figure, well, these are blue states primarily that are concerned about this. I don't think that's necessarily true, but that may be his thinking. And he has shown a willingness to punish blue states for things in the past. So who knows when it's in his head? But obviously New York City and New York State are vital to the national economy. You can't punish New York City without punishing the entire country.
That's true. Terry Gibson.
Well, we know one thing is that Donald Trump will never admit failure. Regardless of what comes out of this, he will claim victory, never admit failure, never take responsibility. We also know that he loves chaos. He loves to exist in a world of chaos, and he's a master of creating chaos. And I think that chaos has trickled down even to his own party. He doesn't really care where the chaos goes. He's just happy to have it, even if it's within his own party. Which I think is part of why they can't bring any kind of unity to this and get on the same page. I do agree with Alan. I think the president is calling the shots here. I think he's looking for a way to say that I saved you. I saved America. Aren't I great? Reelect me. And I think he's looking for that option. I'm not optimistic that he's going to find it because I don't think that his administration is capable of putting forth a sensible plan and getting enough people to vote for it. And I agree with Chris, anybody that's ever worked in state or local government understands how vital this federal funding portion of this deal is. If we don't get money to our local municipalities, our towns, our villages, and certainly the state government, it's going to have a devastating impact on employment and the economy. And I'm sure that Governor Cuomo has put enormous pressure on the New York delegation and certainly Senator Schumer. And I'm sure that they're fighting for that right now.
As a professor of communication, do you think that his communication style serves him? I know it's a sort of broad question, but I am perpetually scratching my head, and I'm wondering what it is that he thinks he gains out of this as his numbers go down. You're the communication expert. Tell us what he's thinking.
Yeah, but I'm not a psychologist. you want me to analyze a person who appears to, by all measurable accounts, to be insane. It works for him. His communication style works for him. He is most comfortable psychologically, mentally. He's most comfortable in a state of chaos. He has an incredibly high tolerance for chaos. And is when things stabilize, that's when he gets nervous. So he must always have chaos. It's mandatory. He will say whatever he has to say to keep the chaos moving. And I think that strategy has worked very well for him so far. And it certainly has kept the media jumping all over the place. And he's many times benefited from their willingness to jump over to one side of the aisle to the other, from one shiny object to the other. So it's purposeful.
He did get – well, it is purposeful, and he did get to be president of the United States. I think a lot of people have forgotten that, using that style. But I think he had a number of other things going for him, right? In other words, if you think of some of the things that people loved about him, he was different. He was outside the political system. He wasn't the same old, same old. But I think they know better now, and so the communication style remains the same, right? So if it remains the same, is it going to work for him?
I don't think so. I think America is tiring of this act. They're tiring of this reality show, and the poll numbers are showing that. And you're right. If anything, he is consistent. He's been this way since we met Donald Trump back in the 80s. I mean, he has never changed his operating style.
Sienna.
Well, I was excited to hear that the talks were moving forward, because I was afraid, as an immigration attorney, we're always afraid of executive orders. So what we don't want to do is have the talks fall apart. And then here we are with President Trump being able to use his favorite thing, is issuing an executive order, which we know would not address Chris's state and local funding issue at all. So, I was excited to see that, because the idea of another executive order coming out of the White House, which is haphazard and poorly drafted and not well thought out, was terrifying to me. So I was just excited to hear that they may have, hopefully, crossing our fingers, working on something in terms of the release bill.
When you think of how this is going to go, it does seem, Alan, like time is ticking, right? I mean, it is we're obviously getting closer to the election, but summer's winding down. But also, this crisis is only intensifying, and people are now a week or so without any benefits, and it's going to start to really impact the economy more so than it already has.
This is the kind of thing that brings on political revolution. It does. I mean, you take a look at the history of the world, you find out when people finally had enough, it's almost always when they get to the point where there's no food on the table, or whether, they have to start to rob in order to feed their children. And this is a tough time. And we see some of the political results already in some districts where the so-called progressives are beating people who are fixtures where they are. So there's you're right about the chaos. That is exactly right. That is his stock in trade. Whether it works for him this time, I don't know.
Sienna?
Will it work for him? Okay. Oh, go ahead.
No.
No, go ahead.
Sienna?
Oh, no, I was going to piggyback on what Alan said, because we were watching the primary come down last night with Cori Bush.
Yes,
that's
who
right.
Who won over in Missouri, exactly, and who's a Black Lives Matter supporter. She's pals with AOC, and you're just seeing these really progressive, less moderate Democrats unseat people. I think it was Lacey Clay. She's been there for 5 decades. So it's definitely a revolution.
And her father was before her, right?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Terry?
Political institutions, yeah.
I was just continuing on the chaos theme. I think that he has it's worked well for him, and I think what we saw is that it worked for him during the impeachment trials as well. I think his messaging kept Republicans from being able to solidify around doing anything that would actually be sensible, like removing him from office, which ultimately probably would have helped them. And also what we saw, which I think is key right now in these negotiations, is we saw that he has managed to take full control of the Republican Party. They are just unwilling to cross him. And we're seeing right now that their lack of ability to really take control of this negotiation process and just leave it to his administration, he's calling the shots, I have no doubt about it. And they're not going to cross him, and they're going to ultimately agree to whatever the administration comes up with. Well, which is going to be a negotiation between them and the Democrats.
If you were a Republican, would you cross him? Come on now.
I would never be a Republican, so it's very difficult for me to put myself in that role.
But if the tables were returned, and this was a Democratic issue.
If I were my own rebellious personality put inside of a conservative Republican body, I suppose, yes, I would cross him.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
And I was thinking: Is he running the party, or are they distancing themselves from him? I saw it more as Mitch McConnell distancing himself from him after seeing the poll numbers. Maybe they're just stepping away.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they have been putting a little distance between themselves and the. I mean, at least a lot of them are. I mean, yeah, they're looking at the poll numbers. It's a delicate dance they have to play. They can't upset the base. They have to get the base out to vote. But at the same time, if they want independent votes, they do have to put a little distance between themselves and the president. You know, and I would disagree with Terry that this has worked for Trump, the chaos theory. I mean, yeah, he got elected. But, you know, that the circumstances around that election were pretty unique. And I don't know that that was necessarily reflects on the success of his style more than it does just the his opponent and all the other things that happened during that election. And he's just been,
we have to,
all throughout his tenure, he's been a very unpopular president.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and Terry Gibson making up the group this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. All right. A couple of letters, and we'll continue on this topic. Regardless of the amount of the stimulus package, Robert writes, has there been any talk of how to pay for this package? And the last one, with the Republicans' pledge not to raise taxes, where will the money come from? Will they just blame the Democrats as being spendthrifts when we have to raise taxes in order to balance the budget and reduce the debt? It's a good question, Alan.
The money will come from borrowing, right? We all know that. When you borrow, you pay vigorous, you pay interest. Then the interesting question becomes, who makes out like the bandits as a result of the interest? People on the street or the banks, I suspect so, will make out. And we'll be paying so much vigorous that money will not be eligible to go for things like schools, mental health facilities, all the things that our listeners and people who write to us care about. But it's clear you don't get a free ride here. You still have to borrow.
Chris?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I do think the deficit and the amount of spending is a concern. You know, it's just hard to take seriously anybody who, you know, in Congress at least, who raises that concern now when they weren't raising that concern before the pandemic. I mean, it just seems a little bit too convenient to all of a sudden be concerned about spending when the federal government's been running up, you know, handing out tax cuts and running up huge deficits for years now.
Terry, anything you'd like to add?
I don't think you have a president in place right now that really cares about this issue. I mean, his track record as a business person is one that doesn't really worry about these small little details. Yeah. Somebody will take care of it at some point. So I just don't think it's a priority.
Sienna?
I agree with Alan. This is going to come from more spending. I mean, just more borrowing from the banks. The budget is right now is $721 billion annually. I just Googled it just to see where we're at. That's
we got a very real time woo out of you too. That was oh Jesus, that's good. Let's see. We'll go to Russ, who says Donald Trump only says what makes himself feel good, regardless of what happens as a result. 2016 was a completely different year. He is who he is, and nobody is going to convince him otherwise. And if he did try to change now, he would emotionally implode because it would be an admission of being a quote-unquote loser, something that he cannot accept. He'd explode into smithereens right there in the Oval Office, just like all the drummers for Spinal Tap did. there's a reference for you. Let's see. We have we also have this from Mark, who says, in the remaining months before the election, this is from Tristan. Good morning, panel. Do you think Russian influence may have any impact on the reluctance of Republicans to cross Trump? There was that scandal with Russian donations through the NRA, the Russian hacking of RNC servers, and the meeting several Republicans had in Russia a year or two ago. Maybe the Russians have embarrassing information they are holding over their heads.
Well, that certainly is a theory about their relationship with Trump. I don't know that it's a comprehensive, the Republicans are in Russian hands, but it is extraordinary. I want to just go back and ask all of you this question. Can you imagine for a single second if Obama or anybody else was caught playing footsie with the Russians? I mean, you know, they would have been irate. They would have yelled and screamed and threatened impeachment. And here, there's almost nothing coming out of these people. And that's the Russians.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to look to conspiracy theories to figure out why Republicans have been unwilling to cross Trump. I mean, I just think they look at the numbers, his popularity among the base, and they look at kind of the tribalism that has kind of overtaken our politics to the point where it almost doesn't matter what your guy does, you support him no matter what, just on the assumption that he's better than the other team. You know, Trump has a core, you know, drive around rural parts of this country. You see the Trump flags flying all over the place. I mean, he has a core constituency that any Republican would be foolish to cross if they want to get reelected. So it doesn't surprise me at all that they have stayed relatively loyal to him.
Yeah, but they're going to die sooner or later. Everybody dies.
I know. Yeah, I know.
And then.
Yeah. Well, I think they realize that. I mean, I think they all see that they're heading over the cliff, but I think that they're in between a rock and a hard place. They can either annoy a rabid base that is small but rabid, or they can try to appeal to the people who are not in that rabid base. And it's a difficult choice, which is why I think, as Sienna said earlier, you're seeing them kind of try to play this thing where they have a foot in each camp. They're trying to kind of move to the middle and put a little distance between themselves and Trump, but at the same time, not trying to cross him to the point where they get tweeted about.
Yeah. But, you know, when I talked about political, when I talked about they're going to die, I didn't mean they're going to die politically, which they are. I meant they're going to die. Sooner or later, you die. And as you're dying on your way up or down, you think about what your contribution was. And I'm simply saying, what is that tombstone? What are people going to be known for? My wife is on her way to Kinderhook right now. What is he known for? go ahead.
Alan, I'm obviously talking about political, you know, calculations more than the honorable thing to do. Obviously, those two things are across purposes a lot of the time.
When's the last time we did the honorable thing?
Well, yeah. I think that
no offense to Terry, but you know, politicians do tend to think mostly about being reelected ahead of the honorable thing. I don't know if Terry still considers himself a politician or not. But.
Well, I'm a recovering politician, but to Alan's
point, you still
point,
have the stink on you.
To Alan's point, I think that when you are a politician who has spent your entire life in politics, that's not me, and when you have been in office for 20 or 30 years, I think dying takes on sort of a different meaning. It's not about whether you go up or down. It's about what kind of legacy do you leave behind. And I think many of these senators and congressional members that are possibly on their way out because things have changed are starting to think about what their legacy is and how do they want to go out. Do they want to go out being known as holding the line and supporting the Republican cause and supporting the base, or do they want to go out being perceived as somebody who was willing to buck the system? And I think many of them are choosing to go out having held the line.
And there aren't many buckers, are there?
No.
In other words, one wonders whether or not they will ever come to grips with the fact that history is going to judge them very, very severely.
Well, it all depends on who's writing that history book. I think it look how history judged the Confederate Army. We ended up building, statues to them. So many of these individuals may very well have statues built to them at some point in time.
The Mitch McConnell statue.
Well,
I'm speechless.
There were Mitch McConnells back during the Confederate, war. So it could happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a sobering thought, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I love the idea that Mitch McConnell, of all people, is now advising his people. We're hearing this and reading it in the papers. It's time to step away a little bit from this president. Basically, they're on the Titanic, and Mitch McConnell is in his captain's hat and he's yelling, save yourself.
Yeah.
Save yourself now.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Which brings up the question before we go to a break in 90 seconds. Can these individual senators, given and House members, given that they have been tied to the ship for so long, can they save themselves?
The answer is no. They cannot. I mean, I don't see it. Look, they're on the wrong side of many of these polls. Take somebody like Susan Collins or the others. Now, Susan Collins can and will come over to the Democratic side on key issues, I am sure, in order to save herself. And she's hinted at that before. But I don't know that it's going to work this time.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, Susan Collins is an interesting case, and you could look at her and say, well, there's somebody who's been relatively independent-minded, and look what it's gotten her, right? She's infuriated the base in Maine, the Republican base, and she's not really won over skeptical independence, so she's kind of left in this a little bit of a limbo where she doesn't really have she's vulnerable, right? And maybe if she had been more rabidly pro-Trump, she'd be in a better situation. I kind of doubt that, knowing the politics of Maine. But I don't think any Republican is going to look at her and think, oh, yes, that shows me that I should be, that I should distance myself from Trump.
And a lot of us have.
She has done in a lot of cases, by the way.
Really?
I do think she's been someone. I do. Yeah, I think she's been willing to criticize the president when necessary. I think, you can look at certain votes here or there, but I think compared to most of the Republicans in Congress, I think she certainly has distanced herself.
Well, she's from a different
place.
You
don't agree with that?
No. She's from a different place.
I'm having problems with that one too, Chris, I must say.
This is a state that elects Democrats or independents now and then. Objecting is one thing, but or saying something at some point, but when the chips were down,
the votes.
She wasn't there.
Yeah.
Right.
The votes.
Well, you're talking about impeachment primarily, right? Would she be better off in Maine right now if she had voted for impeachment? I kind of doubt it.
I don't know.
Mm.
Yeah.
A tough one.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. We got this letter from Patricia who said, I'd really like to hear from the panel about the White House call to end the census gathering a month early. I don't understand what is gained by this action. The action seems to hurt both blue and red states, but much will be lost, including a congressional seat in New York, if the numbers aren't right. So reading a little bit more about this, with census count finishing early, fears of a skewed tally rises. The decision was made by the Trump administration to end the count 4 weeks early. The Census Bureau now has to accomplish what officials have said it cannot do: accurately count the nation's hardest to reach residents, nearly 4 of every 10 households, in just 6 weeks. The result is both a logistical challenge of enormous proportions that must take place in the middle of a pandemic, and yet another political crisis for the census, historically a nonpartisan enterprise. The announcement, which came Monday evening, immediately generated sharp criticism. On Tuesday, 4 former directors of the Census Bureau issued a statement warning that an earlier deadline would result in seriously incomplete enumerations in many areas across our country.
So somebody thinks they know what they're doing, Joe. In other words, who is this? Who will the shortening of the census hurt the most? Will it, for example, and I'm going to hypothesize, I don't know, hurt the blue states, which have major cities in them, for example? And if the Trump people think that the citizens in the cities are not answering the door, and it's a good way of underrepresenting those blue states so that they lose a congressman. And by the way, you just read lose a congressman. No, I think it's lose two. We know we're going to lose one, but I think that there's a good possibility we're going to lose two here as a result of this. And especially if people are afraid to answer the door because they may have somebody. I don't know what we can say about this, but if they have somebody sitting in the house who doesn't want the door answered because it might be ICE, I think they know what they're doing, and I think there's a political reason behind it.
Let's go to the immigration attorney, Sienna.
Good idea. Who may know what she's talking about?
Yeah. I think it is going to negatively impact the immigrant community, people of color, rural areas. And I think the state attorney general's office needs to get involved again. Last year, when they tried to do the citizenship question, it was the state attorney general's office of New York and California that sued and was successful. So this is where we're looking to our attorney general's office to protect the census. And they need to do it again very soon to ensure that there is still an extension that goes on so that everyone is counted. But this is going to end up with litigation. There needs to be litigation fast.
And I assume that will come very soon.
We are hopeful.
We are hopeful. Chris,
we're waiting. We're watching.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to result in an undercount. I mean, it's pretty clear. Who that affects more, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, there are a lot of big cities in red states. Although it gets a little tricky because you look at a state like Texas, the big cities are generally blue areas, right? So you're undercounting the population in blue areas, but you are potentially reducing the overall count for the state, which would decide how many congressional seats the state gets.
You can talk about cities. But LA and New York City are pretty big cities, aren't they, Chris? And they're in Democratic
states. They are,
but
so is Houston, so is Dallas. I mean, there are big cities in states like Florida and Texas. I mean, Houston's the fourth largest city in the country at this point. It's a very, very diverse place, and a place with huge immigrant populations, including probably more undocumented immigrants than many northern cities. I think generally it probably does benefit the GOP to have an undercount, but I don't think it's as clear-cut as people sometimes make it seem.
Well, but would you stipulate, Chris, that that the White House probably knows what it's doing when it calls for this, that they're not doing it just for the hell of it. They're doing it because they think they're going to make out as a result of it.
I'm not sure this White House often knows what it's doing, to be honest with you. I mean, it,
well, there's a reason you call it off a month early, though.
Well, the reason
think that it benefits them in certain ways, but they've often been wrong. Their instincts about what benefits them have often been off, so I'm not entirely sure. But that is probably what they think, yes.
Well, don't they have people who are capable of looking at the numbers as they've been as they've got them already and say this could help us or this could hurt us?
Yeah, but who's interpreting those numbers? That's where you have to. I mean, the person that ultimately looks at those numbers and makes a decision is the president, and I don't think there's really a they. I think it's all him. I think this is a decision that came down from him. Donald Trump thinks that stopping the census will help him. You have to remember, this person doesn't care about anybody but himself. He doesn't care if he hurts or helps.
I'll stipulate to that. You're right. You're right about that.
He doesn't care. So if he thinks this will help him, he's going to do it. Now, also, you got to remember, this is the same person who is theoretically in charge of a national program to help get us through this coronavirus crisis. Look what kind of chaos that is. Every government system that's in place, whether it be healthcare or the census or the coronavirus strategy, they're in chaos because the person at the top has no ability to organize anything of this magnitude. He only knows how to blow it up. So he's blowing it up. It's like he blows everything else up.
Well, can I say that I think there's a silver lining to this? So I know.
Oh, we don't allow that on the show, but go ahead. No.
If you recall, the Trump administration originally asked for an extension, and now they're going backwards. So what this may mean is that they may realize, because they're trying to get these results to his desk by December 31st, they may be realizing that Trump may not be reelected. Because they originally asked for an extension, I think some bedtime early in March when this happened, and they put it on hold. So what they're realizing is, hey, he may not be reelected. Let's get these results back to him. That's the little silver lining.
That's
possible.
I think there's
a lot to that.
That's possible, but I also think, you know, their extension was intended to try to just delay it and not even have a census at all. I did just want to point out that I know someone very closely who is going through census training right now in New York State, and it is chaotic. It is disorganized, and it is clear that from the very, very tip top of this process, already the people that are going to be asked to go out into the field and do this effort are not being given the adequate tools, training, time that they're going to need to do this. And it's a chaotic state, and it's very dangerous because it's going to impact much more than just the congressional seats, which will impact Republicans too, but it's going to impact more economic hits to local governments and municipalities whose residents are going to not be counted and therefore are not going to receive urgently needed federal funding.
Here's 20 questions. Is the person you know a relative?
Yes.
Do they want to come over and count us? Kate,
I think you're outside the district. Okay. They're counting.
Yeah. Kate writes to us and asks this question: once this buffoon is out of office, is it not feasible to retake the census with reasonable people at the helm? Probably not, right?
Yeah. Oh no, I think a lot of things.
Sure.
You mean for this particular census?
Yes.
Well, I think to what was just said before.
Come on, everybody, let's start again.
Well, there will be litigation, as was just mentioned earlier. There will be litigation, and it is conceivable that there could be litigation to the level that it's determined that something does need to be done over. It's possible.
It'll come right down to John Roberts once again, because John Roberts seems to have this new index that he's looking at, which is, for the most part, he's a conservative, and he goes along with those guys. But he also is a guy who looks at major rights and wrongs. And this may be on the wrong side of the ledger, if you think about it, once it gets to the Supreme Court.
Stephanie writes to us and says, I am a census enumerator in a rural area. Undercounting means rural areas get less funding. This is a huge problem everywhere. Undercounting hurts everyone.
Well, but not equally. I mean, I get what Stephanie's saying, but not equally. if you're in the White House and if you're stroking your chin and going,
oh, thank God. Okay.
My statisticians are telling me that the blue states will hurt more than the red states. If that's the case, I'm going along with Chris here. But if that's the case, and I'm right about that, obviously he knows what he's doing. Am I wrong,
Chris?
Yeah, I do think you're wrong if you think he knows what he's doing. I think time and time again.
God help us.
He may have somebody who's telling him that, you know, but time and time again, he's gone against his own interests. I do think it will result in a greater undercount of blue areas than red areas, generally speaking. But
so we're together on that,
people
right?
People make it out to be where, yeah.
So we're together on that.
Yeah, blue and by the way,
yeah.
Yes. Susan Collins has voted with Trump 67.5% of the time, according to 538, which is easily the lowest of any Republican, is way lower than most Republican senators. I mean, it's the lowest overall percentage.
So you give her credit for that?
Independent minded.
So you give her credit for that?
I do.
Coming from the state of Maine, where they elect independents and Democrats. You're giving her credit for that, but it's still 67% with this guy. You know, I think the reason that the polls are going against her right now, and by the way, I've been corrected on polls all week long, but the latest polls, I think, are showing that she's behind in this race. And there's a reason, because I think the people in Maine have great suspect of her motives.
Well, I mean, yeah, I do think her voting record has a lot to do with where the place that she represents. It is an independent-minded place, and they do like independent-minded senators. I mean, they have literally an independent in Angus King as their other senator. So, I mean, that kind of shows you where the voters there are coming from. But even still, I mean, she's like, you know, Mitt Romney, who's kind of a well-known Trump critic, has voted with him 81% of the time. You know, John McCain, 83% of the time. So she has a record of independence that she can point to. The point I was trying to make earlier is that there's no reward for it, really. I mean, there's certainly not any reward for it nationally. She's kind of been villainized, even though she's been villainized among Democrats, even though she's been the most willing to vote with them. And she's been villainized among Republicans because she's crossing the party and crossing Trump. So there's really people who want to do the right thing are put in a tough position.
My favorite.
But sometimes it's the right thing to do, which is to do the right thing, right? Stephen's mother told him that. You ask who Stephen is. We'll get into that some other time.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. I still am reminded of our dear friend Andy Borowitz, who writes the Borowitz Report on the New Yorker online, who had the headline, Susan Collins takes hours to decide on lunch before ordering exactly what Mitch McConnell is having. We'll take a break, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jennifer Higdon is the composer we are listening to this morning, listening to a piece called All Things Majestic. We do have a playlist online, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. We also welcome your letters for the panel, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right, let's go to new topic and find out what else is on the mind of our panelists this morning, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Terry Gibson. We go to the problem of test delays. It's like having no tests at all, some are saying. And also because the turnaround time is quite great. We heard an anecdotal story from our own J.P. Miller yesterday on the panel, who had a test on Wednesday and got his result back on Sunday. A shortage of chemicals needed to test for the virus is a part of what is slowing down the turnaround times. Frustrated by a nationwide testing backlog, the governors of six states took the unusual step of banding together on Tuesday to reduce the turnaround time for coronavirus test results from days to minutes. The agreement by three Republican governors and three Democratic governors was called the first interstate testing compact of its kind. The six states, Louisiana, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and Virginia, agreed to work with the Rockefeller Foundation and two U.S. manufacturers of rapid tests to buy 3 million of them. The bipartisan plan highlights the depth of the testing problems in the United States more than 6 months into the pandemic. The U.S. is testing about 755,000 people a day, up from about 640,000 per day a month ago, and far more than in April and May, according to the COVID Tracking Project. But numbers alone do not tell the whole story. With testing chemicals and other equipment in short supply and a surge in coronavirus cases nationwide leading to skyrocketing demands, many Americans are still having to wait many days for results, effectively rendering those tests useless. All right, who would like to begin on this?
I'll start.
Okay.
First of all, I just think it's a strange conglomeration of states. Louisiana and Massachusetts are working together on this. Who would have ever thought that would happen? And second, when we talk about the lack of national leadership on this topic and the need for these Republican and Democratic governors to come together and find a solution, I always wonder, what would happen if our country was attacked by a foreign enemy, say some type of a missile attack? What would happen? Would the current administration just tell each and every state that you're on your own, that you'll have to go out and buy your own missile launchers, you'll have to mount your own defense? Is that the way we would fight a war? It seems like it is, because this is a war. We are being attacked, and there is absolutely no federal leadership coming to the rescue of this country.
Chris?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I think no, Chris should go. Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry.
I agree with Terry. The fact that these states are doing this just points to the fact that the federal government hasn't stepped up in the way that it should. I mean, it is remarkable to see Louisiana and Massachusetts partnering on anything. And I'm not exactly sure how it'll work, but the fact that they feel the need to do so really tells you everything you need to know.
Can anybody really believe that this country, this great country, Einstein's a selected abode and all the rest, could not come up with a similar test to the pregnancy test? In other words, spit on this piece of paper and you'll know whether you have the COVID or not. Of course they could do that. And it's, I think that's what this is. And I want to answer the question about what if a missile was coming, if a missile was coming this way. I think the answer is, and if Trump were the president, it would depend on whether it was coming from Russia or China.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It would depend on whether it was headed for a blue state or a red state.
Perhaps. Yeah, that's sad.
Yep.
Sienna?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on this bandwagon, but it's just crazy to see the testing where it's at, and then everyone's still saying, reopen the schools, and now the schools are reopening, and we're seeing these outbreaks. You have to have these children tested. It's just very disheartening right now to watch.
Second grader in Georgia,
exactly.
Just today, yeah.
And it's just disheartening, and they're still touting reopen the schools. And even when Dr. Bricks came out and kind of tried to encourage a little bit distance learning, you know, she got called pathetic by the president. So it's just, with testing not where it needs to be and millions of children about to enter the school, it just seems like a bad situation, a tumultuous situation. Like, it's going to be really bad. I don't know.
I'm interested.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
Well, to speak to Terry's war example, I mean, that's pretty clearly an example of, something that falls within the federal government's parameters. And it's a little bit more complicated with the virus, I think, because there are decisions that local government should be left to local governments, right? I mean, I think it should be up to local governments or state governments, whether the school is open or, whether masks are mandatory and all that sorts of stuff. But there is obviously a role for the federal government, too, and that's to do things like, mobilize so that there are enough tests and enough PPE and enough equipment. And it's, there was there was definitely a need for strong federal leadership, and it just never really happened.
There was a letter that went out to students at the University at Albany this morning that said, given reported delays for COVID-19 test results and a lack of testing availability in some areas, all University at Albany students should be tested as soon as possible in order to have results prior to beginning of fall classes. And you just have to wonder, as this push goes on, certainly by the administration and by others, to have schools, but yes, colleges as well, to begin. Part of this is all about testing. And if we don't have the testing and kids can't get it done in time, because it seems that right now we're at a point that adding however many thousands of kids going in to get tests on top of it isn't going to improve the situation.
Not only that, Joe, but 8 to 10 days, a lot can happen. You go back to school.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, you know, and within 8 to 10 days, believe me, you can have social interactions which create, for want of a better word.
And they are saying results from tests taken on or after July 26th will be accepted, but it's a great point. I mean, and still, so then what, you know, is it still good?
Yeah, but I know we could do better. And by the way, I want to react, if I can, to Chris's very good comment about, you know, the state responsibilities and federal responsibilities. No, I think in this particular case, the president of the United States should have gotten up there and said, should have gotten up there and said, everybody wears a mask in this country. And any state that does this and enforces this, we'll give some extra candy to. I mean, I think this is the time for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was necessary, but I do think he should have been clear about the benefits of mask wearing, right? I mean, the messaging is so important in this scenario. Obviously, you know, the president would say a responsible thing 1 minute and then reverse himself in a tweet, you know, 30 minutes later. If he had just been, I actually don't think managing this, maybe I'm just being kind of arrogant, but I actually don't think managing this virus from his point of view would have been all that difficult. You leave a lot of the biggest decisions up to the states, and you send clear guidance and clear messaging about what you want, you know, and
it wouldn't be that tremendous.
If there's one thing you're not,
missed opportunity. I mean,
if there's one thing you're not, Chris, it's arrogant. You are not an arrogant.
What?
I just want to step in make that clear.
Well, I don't want to make it sound like if I were president, I would know exactly how this should have been done. But you know,
if I were president,
it's an incredible missed opportunity. If I had been president, in February, and I'd be looking at low approval numbers, you could say, well, this is my chance to really show people that I know how to lead and get things done. That I can be consistent, that I can be relevant. And Trump kind of blew the opportunity, and you know he's going to lose the election because of it. I'm 98% sure of that.
It's the 2% that worries
me. Going a full 100, but
yeah,
yeah. Well, yeah.
Terry?
I agree. Chris is not arrogant. And I don't remember what I was going to say.
Oh, okay. All right. That's
but,
fine.
But I think what I will say is that you would expect, as Chris said, that any sane president with even a medium level of management skills would have jumped at the opportunity to take control of the situation and come out of it as a real hero. But there's just nothing in Donald Trump's past that shows that he's willing or able or even interested in acting like that. And so we're left with nothing really. And it is so disturbing. And you have to look at the Republican leadership in the Senate and in the House. And, you know, why aren't they making more noise? Why aren't they demanding that their party, their administration, take control of this and show some leadership? They're even leaving their Republican governors to struggle.
Well, you already know that. You know why. We've discussed it 100 times. They're afraid of losing their dumb offices, and you know, and that's the way that they behave. I keep coming back to. I'm sorry, nobody's going to like this, but I keep coming back to the Russians. I don't understand. I just don't get it. You know, if Putin had his way in this country, there would be chaos. He's got a president who generates chaos and who simply will not say a bad word about the Russians. Well, maybe I'm way off base and maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect something very strange is happening here. Because, you know, when you say Terry, that we don't understand why he behaves this way, it could be mental illness, no question, but it also could be in bed with this, if you know what I'm saying here.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't get it. There's got to be a reason that he acts like an imbecile.
Well,
besides the fact that he could be an imbecile, right?
I mean, he could be an imbecile.
By the way, that's putting a bad mark on imbeciles.
And Jim writes to us and says, "Good morning on this beautiful day. There should be only one debate, and it should be moderated by Chris Wallace and Jonathan Swan. If you don't answer the question or you lie, your microphone is shut off and the next candidate is called on. This is too important to run it like a game show." That just gives us a moment to talk about Jonathan Swan's Axios interview that aired on Sunday night on HBO. It's now making the rounds on online. I did watch it last night. It is have you all seen it?
I saw it.
Yeah.
I've seen clips.
Yeah,
he was terrific.
My goodness.
How did he get in there?
Well, he's a young guy, 34 years old, an Australian, and comes in and he does all of the things that everyone has been yelling about that reporters and journalists have done should have been doing for a long time, of fact checking on the moment. And muttering a lot under his breath of correcting him as he was going along, and really getting to him to a point where he seemed to lose it.
It was a career maker if I ever saw one.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Watching him with these pieces of paper that had clearly just been printed out on some color copier moments before the interview, you know, flailing them around, saying,
When you say him, you're talking about the president.
The president.
Yes. Yes.
But not even, they didn't even look like the one was just of just a line going up. You know, I mean, it wasn't like it was real scientific. It was just
like first grade graphs. Right, they were like paint by number graphs,
and a bar chart with like three colors. It was really weird, and how quickly Jonathan Swan dismissed them was great. Okay, you're talking about this. I'm talking about deaths.
Somebody's been fired today. Somebody's been fired for letting him in there.
Well,
yeah, but didn't we say the same thing after the Chris Wallace interview, and then then you know another one come a week or two later.
I think he has the confidence. Well, you know, this is a question that my wife and I had last night after watching it. Do you think? Because she did. She said, "Don't you think that when he got up, the president got up, he probably looked and said, I did a great job on that."
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. He's incapable of criticizing himself. Mm. He's incapable of looking inward and trying to figure out how he can improve himself. He's not capable of doing that. So.
But you see instances in which the president makes a fool of himself, and you see a White House reaction getting him to react in a different way.
Yeah.
So it's not as if, you know, he always feels I'm right about everything and won't listen to the others, because sometimes he has to. Maybe it's McConnell calls him on the phone. Who knows?
Yeah, but he seemed to walk into so many things yesterday. That interview was taped a week ago and just aired on Sunday. But it was, you know, the John Lewis thing. That was really
that was awful. Yeah.
The one thing where I think he said that the China issue was worse than climate change. There was a lot there that came out that I think we'll be hearing about for a while. Back to Jim's point about the debates, though, there is some pressure mounting among some Democratic leaders and Republicans as well that believe that there shouldn't be any debates, or if there is, there should only be one. Many of the venues, as we've noted before, have bailed out and said, I think two of the three venues have bailed, and alternate locations have either been found or are in the process of being found for them. And the Democratic line on this seems to be, yes, we understand that it would look bad if Biden says he's going to duck the debate. But by the same token, is it good to give the president yet another forum for 90 minutes or 2 hours to go unchecked and just give this litany of untruths as he did in 2016?
Well, I think that's this whole idea of not debating is just one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. I mean,
you are so right. You are so right.
You're right. I mean, it's up to if Trump says untrue things, Biden has to be prepared and be ready to point them out. I mean, that's what a debate is. And I think we have to trust the American people a little bit. I mean, when Trump gets in front of a microphone, he often makes a fool of himself. So why not assume that the American people will be able to see this in a 90? I mean, it should be obvious in a 90. If Biden can't beat him in a debate, then Biden probably doesn't deserve to be president, to be honest with you. I mean, it shouldn't be that difficult of a job.
Well, Biden does deserve to be president. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sienna.
No, I was just going to say, I understand what you're saying, but I do think there's some validity to the argument that make this a Trump versus Trump election. I mean, he's pretty much shooting himself in the foot, as we see. And so to allow him to keep going on these interviews and answering the same question wrong both times and not being prepared, it speaks to, you know, Trump is, you know, kind of digging his own grave with this election. Whereas, and we know this, Biden's not, he's not a clean campaigner either, right?
No,
and
no,
so
right.
There is something to that. No. There is something to that, that theory that just Trump go versus Trump and let Biden kind of sit back. And yes, there should be a debate, obviously, because we need to hear Biden on the issues very clearly. But I do think Biden needs to sit back a little bit and let Trump do this by himself.
Well, Biden,
I mean, that's what Biden is doing. Biden has been very, very smart about just letting Trump kind of keep shooting himself in the foot. But I think eventually he is going to have to emerge from the basement. I mean, he can't expect to sit there and, you know, let sit there forever. Eventually, he's going to have to, you know, do a face-to-face.
Well, he didn't exactly distinguish himself, Biden, in the debates with his colleagues when running for, you know, in the Democratic primaries. Nevertheless,
but he was okay in that one-on-one debate against Sanders. When it was one-on-one, he was fine. He was fine.
The best you'll give him is a C+, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's.
But he also needs. I mean, the Republican narrative is that he's this puppet who's basically senile, right? And who will be controlled by the vice president or whomever. He does need to counter that narrative a little bit. And in a way, Trump has lowered the bar for Biden so much by making it seem as though he can't put a sentence together. But if Biden just shows up and is reasonable and coherent, I think he'll do himself a lot of good.
He's going to need a lot of practice before that debate, I'll tell you right now. They better have somebody good with him.
Well, yeah. Right.
And of course, there is the issue of the tax returns. I mean, we've heard from many people here on the panel who have written to us and said, yeah, tell him we'll debate when he releases his tax returns. It won't work, but it sort of ought to be part of the rhetoric.
I'm just trying to figure out who's going to play the role of Donald Trump in the rehearsals for the debate. For Joe Biden's team, who do you think that will be? Because it's important. He does need to have a good trainer. So will it be Alec Baldwin? Hey, who knows?
we're gonna take a break and go to go to news here at the bottom. We have a couple of other items to discuss. I have a lot of letters to read too. I would, when we come back, like to get into the question too about the VP pick. I find this, I don't know, I don't want to be conspiratorial, but have a conspiracy theory here, but is it weird, and I don't know the answer to this, but is it weird that we'd heard it was going to be the beginning of this week, and then they said, well, it'll probably be the end of this week, and now they're saying it'll be right by the convention.
Stuff came up.
Yeah, and you just sort of wonder what was going on there. But all right, we'll take a break. We'll pause. We'll come back. We'll talk about that and other things as well. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Terry Gibson, your letters panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. We were talking about Jonathan Swan before the break from Axios, and Axios has a piece this morning about the VP contest and says, just as of about 2 hours ago, confidence of Joe Biden, believe his choices for vice president have narrowed to Senator Kamala Harris and Susan Rice, and would be surprised if he picks anyone else. The state of play, this is a snapshot of nearly unanimous read that they got from more than a dozen people close to him. They say, of course, it comes with a giant asterisk. Only Biden knows for sure, and the more insiders know, the less they say to reporters. He's not expected to announce his choice for another week or so. The Democratic convention begins August 17th, so that reality could certainly change. On what's happening, the campaign is now in a methodical mode as it finalizes vetting, looks at internal polling results on potential picks, and talks to finalists one-on-one. In third place is Representative Karen Bass of California, who had a faltering performance on the Sunday shows after revelations about her past views on Cuba and Scientology. Alan.
Well, you stole my thunder.
I apologize.
Not at all.
Not my intention.
Not at all. I am sure they're polling. I'm sure that's correct. I am sure that they want somebody who the American people is reasonably comfortable with already. And that's why the two that are leading it seems to me, the American people are most comfortable with. The problem for Biden is he's got to be able to get along with one or the other of them. And that is, I think, what our issue is here. As soon as I heard Bass in Scientology, I said, uh-oh, that ain't going to work. She's extremely popular and the rest of it. I don't want to pick on any religion or anything else. But I do know that a lot of people have a lot of questions about that.
I think the Cuba part of it, too, was a fairly big deal. I mean, Biden went after Bernie Sanders pretty aggressively for kind words he'd said about Fidel Castro. It would be kind of tough for him to pick Karen Bass after he did that. Go ahead.
No, anyone else?
I think name recognition is important, and I'm just not convinced that Representative Bass has that kind of name recognition. I think these two choices, Harris and Rice, make sense. I'd be happy with either one of them, but I think the bigger problem is, and something they have to be considering, is that Joe Biden's personality and his just overall demeanor is so easy to upstage. I mean, it's very easy to steal the spotlight from Joe Biden. It's not like a Barack Obama. No matter who you pick as his VP, nobody's going to upstage Barack Obama. And the problem with that is that, you know, he's the one running for president.
So what do you do about
that? Remain on him.
Well, so what do you do about that?
I think Kamala Harris is one of those individuals that could easily steal the spotlight from her just without, by standing beside him.
Without question. Yeah. Without question.
I also think there's a trust issue there. I'm not sure how much Biden trusts her. I mean, you know, they had that little dust up during the debate, which, you know, was fairly significant. If you go back and watch it, there was some real tension there. And I think they're worried that if they pick Harris, you know, she's essentially running for president, you know, on November 4th, if Biden wins, right? And that she's going to be less a loyal vice president and more a candidate on her own right. And I'm sure that's why, in some respects, Susan Rice is appealing to Biden, because, you know, he knows her really well. He probably trusts her. And, you know, she wouldn't automatically be the next president in the eyes of many Democrats.
Sienna?
I agree with what everyone's saying, pretty much. I think Susan Rice is a safe choice for him because he worked with her. But also, I'm concerned about Susan Rice because of the Benghazi situation. We don't want to get the Republicans more fired to bring that up again. And so that's the concern with Susan Rice. But also, like, Kamala, she's, I don't know, spicy, so to speak. And I understand that she may upstage Biden, but she'll also bring some notoriety to the ballot for him. But I also don't want her to do the Palin effect. So that's why I keep thinking about, as you guys discussed it, like, you don't want the Sarah Palin effect where you have this, you know, shooting star vice president that is terribly polarizing.
Yeah, but she's not stupid.
Right. I was going to say, she has a brain in her head, though. As far as I know, even from California, she can't see Russia from her house. Yes?
Harris is pretty polarizing, too, though. If you look at polling data, her unfavorability have always been really, really high. So I don't, you know, I don't think there's a clear choice. I haven't thought there's a real clear choice for Biden since the very beginning. I mean, it's.
But isn't
I want to go to back to Benghazi for a moment, because I think it's a very good point that you make. And that is that why should we. I want to take the pronoun back. That was a mistake. Why should the Democrats reward the Republicans' malfeasance and their disgustingness on this Benghazi thing by saying, we're not going to pick somebody because of the way in which you misbehaved earlier? You know what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I agree completely.
But there is stuff there. There is stuff that Susan Rice did during the immediately after Benghazi that is certainly questionable. You know, and if you're in Biden's position and things are going really well, why give them any line of attack at all if you don't have to?
Because that's impossible. Because they'll make it up no matter what, Chris, as you well know. When we talk about Trump and all his utterances and his mistakes and everything else, and we're saying, okay, well, we shouldn't pick a vice presidential candidate because of one thing that some people will perceive as being bad.
I understand. You know, the interesting thing about Susan Rice is I think she would make a very good vice president. I don't know what kind of candidate she'll make. I mean, she's never run for office before, so it's kind of a high risk pick in a sense.
Well, the Harris thing, the good thing about Harris, right, Chris, is the fact that you can only imagine what a Pence-Harris debate would look like.
Yeah, but she also bombed. She bombed during the primary so badly that I would have, I'm just not sure that I would be confident that she would be the way to go either. You know, the other thing about this, maybe they feel Susan Rice is a little bit safer of a pick because the pandemic has changed the dynamic of a campaign so much that you can kind of wage a quieter. She can kind of be a quieter candidate. She's not going to be speaking to massive crowds and doing all the things that a candidate normally would be doing.
Okay, so I have an honesty question to ask everybody on the panel. I'll go first. I'll go last. If you had today, if you were Joe Biden, who would you pick of those two? You first, Chris.
I'm just want the rules. Out of these two,
Harris and Rice. Yes.
Okay.
I'd pick Rice.
Yeah. Joseph.
Of those two, I would pick Rice. If you opened the field up, I might have a different pick, but.
I like what Sienna said earlier. I think I would pick Senator Harris. She is tested. On the campaign trail. I agree with Chris. I think she did do, she was not good during the debates, but I think she had these canned one-liners and used them and it was awkward. I think you can train that out of a candidate. And I think once you have a little bit of good prep, I think she would be very efficient.
Terry?
Well, I don't know that I would pick either one of them, but
no, you have
I would
to.
Pick Rice.
You have to. You have no choice.
Damn it, pick one.
I would pick Susan Rice if I had to pick one of them. But I kind of think the reason this whole thing is on hold is because they're doing polling and they're seeing that neither one of them is a clear choice.
Sienna?
I would pick Harris. I just think she's a better choice. She has more notoriety. I think that she can be trained to answer the questions correctly. She's sharp. I think she will speak to the Black Lives Matters, defund the police, all of that very well. And as a former prosecutor, I think she would do a good job there. I just don't know Susan Rice enough. So to be comfortable with her being with Joe Biden, we just don't know her. And the Benghazi thing is a big deal to me. I know they could. I'm just afraid of them, you know, bringing that up again the way they did with Clinton. And I just you know, we don't want to see that happen. And
Tucker Carlson has been, Tucker Carlson has been doing this, that, you know, the last two nights, calling her a neocon who, committed these moral
Susan Rice.
I want to get. I forget which panelist was making the point about how easy it is for Joe Biden. Was it you, Chris? About how easy it is for Joe Biden to be upstaged. And
I do think that's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. I
think that may be why Elizabeth Warren isn't the pick, because I think she would, right from the get-go, people would say, well, she's the smarter of the two and the one who should be president.
But you think that the safe, just from what we know, that given Biden's age, given the fact that he has said, you know, that he's looking at this as one term, whether that's true or not, we don't know. But that this is going to be more of a tag team effort than perhaps past races, that you have the two, and they both have their strengths. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, maybe that's why he's looking at Susan Rice, though, because he really has to trust the person. And there have been signs of some trust issues with Harris. I mean, the Chris Dodd comments a week or two ago.
Did you go,
showing
Alan?
No remorse.
Did what?
Alan, did you go?
No, I was hoping I wouldn't have to. No, I would. I would definitely pick
Get
Rice.
On the record.
Yeah,
I would pick Rice.
Yeah.
And the reason is, he's got to like her. He's got to work with her. She's got to play the right role with him. And she can't be a political competitor. I like Morris,
Harris.
Harris. Yeah. I like Harris. I think it should be Rice.
All right. I'm going to go ahead. Anybody else? Did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, it's interesting because you could argue that both are kind of strange picks for the moment. I mean, Rice is kind of famous for her foreign policy chops, and foreign policy isn't really a big issue at the moment. And Harris, you know, you saw what Tulsi Gabbard did to her in one of the debates on her her record as a prosecutor. Yeah. So you could argue that, you know, maybe there's a weakness there, too, that kind of goes against the kind of the national mood.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure foreign policy isn't perfect. An issue. I kind of think we
no, it's an
know,
issue, but I just don't
because we don't have one.
Be...
We don't have a foreign policy right now, and I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, but I agree with Craig. I mean,
no, it is.
It's going to be the pandemic, yeah. Right? Isn't that what everybody's going to be? That's going to be the issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
The thing is, the economy.
A lot of people like this Biden fellow because he's a moderate. And because they want to go back to stability. And I think when you look at that, then Rice becomes an apparent choice.
All right. Yeah. We have about 4 minutes, and I have a lot of letters. So I'm going to try to go through as many as I can very quickly. We go to Dale, who says, I'm not very sanguine about the future of the United States. Regardless of who wins in November, I see the country remaining hopelessly divided. Possibly not violent clashes nor dissolution of the union, but intransigence leading to political stalemate, prospects for the long-run preservation of democracy looking grim. Stacy says, I'm for Susan Rice. I vote for Susan Rice. She has campaigned for others. I like Val Demings, too. Jonathan says, please consider the following. The election of Trump, the mere fact that Trump could get elected, Trump's rabid following and his lock in the Republican Party, the tremendous inequality of wealth and opportunity in the U.S., the complete failure of Trump to react to the pandemic in a rational way, coherent way, is the U.S. now a failed state?
Go back to one of those letters. If you had opened up the let us choose from anybody, I might have chosen Val Demings. I think she makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Yeah,
I want to put a vote in for that, too, that she's always been on my short list.
Kim writes to us and says, nations all over the world are suffering from COVID-19, but many are already stepping up to the plate, offering aid for Beirut after the port explosion. Where is the United States? Joan says, wouldn't it be great to have the debates on Zoom and they could mute each candidate to allow the other to actually answer? Alan, on Russia, I have a question. What more could Trump have done to destabilize the U.S. and promote Russian interests without being run out of office or jailed? I can't think of anything substantive he left on the table, irrespective of his true motive.
Is that a critical letter or
I can't tell. Letter? And I will say there are two words in there that I skipped because they were jumbled and I didn't know what they were.
Well, you know.
So they may have been important. I'm not sure.
I think this guy is in there.
It may have been insults.
I think this guy's in their pocket, in the Russian pocket. I've said it so all along. I think it's so clear from the day he told those ambassadors, I just put an end to the Russian thing by firing Comey. I mean, this guy belongs to them. Terrible.
All right, back to letters and our 2 minutes left. John says he needs Hispanic support more than anything else. So it's to me, it's obvious that it should be Michelle Grisham. We also heard from Barbara, who said, good morning, panel. Regarding the VP choices, I've been rooting for Tammy Duckworth. I feel she could bring in votes from many segments and that she has the brains and brawn to handle the job and whatever it would throw at her.
Yeah, she'd be high on my list, too.
Let's not forget, says Mary, that the Trump administration is operating like a mob, a Russian mob, to be specific, with Putin's puppet at the helm. When we look at the long trail of casualties and people who have opposed and exposed Putin, perhaps part of the GOP loyalty is personal safety and the safety of their families. Adam writes to us and says, government-issued bonds do not affect the federal balance sheet in the same simple way that household or even commercial debt hits a household or business debt. Voters should not think about how it feels to have a mortgage or credit card when considering federal debt. Federal debt does not work the same way. I think you all have oversimplified it a little this morning. Harry Shearer had an economist on the show within the last few months who explained this issue very well. Harry Shearer in his own hot water this week, but yes.
Oh, is he?
Yes.
Good. What did he do?
He spoke out about the producers of the I have to go here, but the producers of The Simpsons, the show that he provides voices for, wanted to hire actors of color for characters of color. He does some of those voices now, and he spoke out and said that that was silly and is getting criticized for it. So.
Pure Harry.
With that, we'll take a break and we'll come back. We're going to remember the great Pete Hamill when we return. We'll be back right after this. My thanks to everybody, Alan and Chris and Sienna and Terry. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.